former Major League Baseball player and current broadcaster for the Washington Nationals, FP Santangelo, joins the show. What do we get into, Big Ben?
The Fighting Hydrant, as he calls himself, or was anointed because he looks like a fire hydrant that wants to fight you. We'll get into his time as a Giant, a Dodger, his time in Miami as a collegiate baseball recruit, and answer all his questions about Barry Bonds, Gary Sheffield, and others that he played with. FP Santangelo coming up right now.
How would you describe the clubhouse and the group of guys when you were there in 2001?
Well, if you've ever watched any sort of documentary on Motley Crue when they were at their height, that was us, but we were playing baseball.
But the first question is we're connected through three mutual friends. We got Anwar Shanahan, Secret Service. We got Eric Burns, Reflexology, Foot Salesman of the Year. And Kevin Franzen, former Philly, former Nat, former Giant. Now he's a broadcaster on the color side for the Phillies. So first question is, if you had to drive across country with one of those three, who would it be and why?
I'd walk first. With either one. No, I'm saying, you're sitting there saying we have three mutual friends. I'm like, those are our three mutual friends? I'm in trouble. I need to start like reevaluating who my friends are, first of all. You guys know exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, that does say a lot about me, right? I mean, you are who your friends are. So maybe I need some counseling and therapy when you mention those three guys' names. But I would probably have to say Burns would drive me nuts after 10 miles. I couldn't. I mean, he's like a brother to me, a former teammate. I was the guy on his way out. Burns was on his way in. So I was his mentor in Oakland. And so I'm like his big brother, but now he doesn't think that. And we fight like brothers. So I couldn't make it 10 miles with Burnsy. I can barely spend like more than one or two days in New York when I go to see him because we're at each other's throat, like in a good way, like a brotherly way. And I'd probably go with Anwar because Franny would drive me nuts too. I'll go with Anwar because I'll just say this. I know we'd stop at all the right places along the way.
That's a good road dog to have with.
Yeah.
All right, FP, you played, we're getting into a segment, MLB teammates. And you grew up out west, which we consider the best coast. Finished your career out east in Miami. Started with the Expos and played for three West Coast teams. What coast is best?
Well, I mean, that's a loaded question. I have to say right now, because I work for the Washington Nationals, that the East Coast is best. But, I, you know, I'm a California guy and I'm a beach guy, so I miss that part. But I also love D.C. It's been a great time here. I've been here for 10 years as the broadcaster for the Nats. I got to experience things as a broadcaster vicariously through the ball club that I never accomplished as a player. So getting to be a part of the community here, I've lived here for 10 years, you know, having beers with the fans, celebrating a world championship with the fans. Even though, you know, I was a Giant, I'll always be a Giant. You know, I played in that organization. I coached in that organization. I cut my teeth as a broadcaster in that organization. And I lived in San Francisco and Half Moon Bay for a long time. I feel like I'm an East Coast guy now. I've been here 10 years. I'm sitting in my house that I've had for 7 years. I live here year round. Because of recency, I have to pick the East Coast.
We won't hold that against you. So during your time with the Expos, you played with Vlad Guerrero. What was it like coming to the park and watching him hit when you two were teammates?
Well, I mean, initially when Vladdy got called up, he was this phenom. And you don't really hear about guys in the minor leagues very often. And a lot like Juan Soto, we heard about Juan Soto here in D.C. when he was in A-ball doing great things. And same goes for Vladdy. We heard about him in A-ball. This guy's hitting 370 in the Gulf Coast League. He's hitting 350. And A-ball. So he finally got called up, I think, as a 19-year-old, maybe 20. I can't remember, with the Expos. And he was a tremendous raw talent. And you guys all know he's famous for being a tremendous bad ball hitter. But early in his career, he didn't know how to play with pain. So, you know, anytime he wasn't 100%, you'd scratch him out of the lineup. So we would sit back his first couple years and go, hey, man, like, you got to know how to play hurt every once in a while. And then once he got that, and he knew that he didn't have to be 100% healthy every single day. Watching him play baseball is like nothing I've ever seen. I mean, one of the best arms I've ever seen. My story that I always tell about Vladdy is he used a different bat every time up. And he would just go in the bat rack and lift up a bat and kind of feel it like this. And he didn't speak English, so he'd look down the dugout and go like, Can I use the bat? Yeah, man, go ahead. It used to piss some guys off. I didn't care if you used my bat. I wasn't using them. Somebody had to use them. But yeah, he was just, we used to say he was like playing wiffle ball in his backyard every night. He had no game plan, but he was such a good bad ball hitter that he was aggressive. And he could hit a ball an inch off the plate in the gap. We've seen him hit balls on hops in the gap, make two sounds, the dirt and his bat. Just a tremendous hand-eye coordination, tremendous talent, and a wonderful human being. You know, he's become a friend over the years, and we had him back at Nats Park last season in 2019. We celebrated the Expos for one day, and Vladdy came back and threw out the first pitch, and we did an interview with him, with a translator up in the booth, and it was just good to see him. He's always smiling, he's always happy, and now he's one of the best players to ever play the game in the Hall of Fame. So I'm proud to say that I played 4 years with him, and probably said three words to him. But we spoke the language of baseball every single day, and he was a great teammate.
FP, how would you compare him to his son?
They're different. I got to see his son play for the first time this year because we did the whole play the American League East thing, and we broadcast some games against the Jays, and they actually stayed in D.C. because they didn't have a place to play for a while. So I got to see Vlad Jr. play. Different style. I mean, Vladdy was an outfielder and long and lanky and gangly. If you remember Vladdy when he was 19 or 20, he was skinny and just all arms and legs flying all over the place in a big long swing and the long arm arc when he threw, and the tremendous talent that he had. And his son's a little bit different. He's more compact. They don't have the same body. And his son was always around, so it's weird for me to see him now playing the big leagues. When he was a kid eating the ice cream cones in the clubhouse, we had the soft serve ice cream machine in the Expos clubhouse, and all the kids would come in after a game if we won. And Vlad's son was always in there. Vlad Jr. was always in there. My son was in there. And now you see him on TV hitting home runs instead of eating ice cream running around the clubhouse.
Must have been some good ice cream there.
So it was awesome. We had to be careful.
You have to look out for the rookie 15. That was the one thing I heard. Once you get to the big leagues, like the food, the spread is unbelievable, that a lot of people eat. And that's when sometimes the excess weight comes on.
Well, I was 26, 27 then. I could eat whatever and be fine. Now if I play the big leagues, I have to watch out as a broadcaster on the charters and stuff now because, they eat this food all over and Haagen-Dazs bars and wine and dessert. You got to be careful. So I still work out every day. But I could see how, like, if some guys had a slower metabolism, they could put on some weight in a hurry.
Definitely. Now, if we move to 1999, San Francisco Giants, you had the opportunity to play with Barry Bonds. What was it like watching him hit every day during that season?
Best player I ever played with, period. And I think the best player to ever play the game. I mean, there's some guys now that you might be able to make an argument with, but just the knowledge of the strike zone always comes to mind, number one. I don't think I ever saw him swing at a ball. The work ethic that nobody really ever talks about, behind the scenes, how he would just, like, you'd come to the ballpark at one and Barry had already been there for an hour hitting the cage if he had like an 0-for-4 the night before. In the ability to not see a strike for 3 or 4 games, and then when you do see a strike to hit it into the water, because you could get passive as a hitter if you start to walk and then all of a sudden you get surprised with a strike. He was never surprised by a strike, and he was always ready for it. He was ready to hit. And just a quick story, I came over there in 99, and one of our first days at camp, the running joke was, "You're stupid, man. You used to hit against us. You're not going to hit now, like, because you're going to take away all the hits that you used to get against the Giants. Now you're a Giant. Like, why would you sign with us?" And I started laughing. I'm like, "Dang, that's a really good point, because I did go against the Giants, and now I am a Giant. So there goes about 20 hits." And he kind of got in my head. And then I was struggling early on in April. And it was, I would say, late April, and I was sitting right around 100. And I walked into the Giants clubhouse one day, and he said, "Hey, you want to learn how to hit?" I'm like, "Of course." He said, "Grab that bucket of balls and meet me in the cage in 10 minutes. And he gave me the best tutorial on hitting I ever had in my entire career, that I've ever heard of my entire career. And he locked me in, and I went from like 150 to 300 in less than a month.
Oh, wow.
And he was... After I got over the fact that Barry Bonds is flipping me soft toss and I better not like hit him and hurt this guy, and a future Hall of Famer is coaching me, and then I could actually like listen and absorb what he said. Unbelievable stuff. And I always say, I've said this on my old radio show on KMBR, that he's the best hitting coach I ever had. No offense to all the hitting coaches I had throughout my career, but just that one day or one couple of days with Barry in San Francisco, I'll never forget.
What was the most memorable moment for you during that 1999 season, Bonds?
With Bonds or just as a Giant?
As a Giant.
I mean, playing last. Well, I mean, Barry was hurt a lot that year, but he, I mean, his BPs and stuff, and especially when we played in Colorado, where he hit it up in the third deck in the Mile High strip and stuff like that, and just playing, you know, center field and playing catch with Barry Bonds between innings, and you're like, I'm playing catch with Barry Bonds, you know, and then he became a friend. But you know, as a Giants, I grew up a Giants fan. I'm from Northern California. I used to go to Giants games as a kid. I actually snuck into Candlestick Park when they were on the road one time when I was a junior in high school and stood at home plate and said, I'm going to hit here someday. And my best friend always tells the story that he thought I was so cocky and full of crap that I actually stood at home plate at Candlestick and said, I'm a player someday. Ended up doing it. So for a kid that grew up in Northern California, used to sit in the bleachers and freeze his ass off at night at Giants games. We used to root for extra innings because they used to give you a pin called the Quad Day Candlestick.
Oh, that's right.
if it went extra innings on a night game. So we used to root for night games. And then to actually play the last season ever and play in the last game ever at Candlestick Park in 1999 is something I'll always remember. I actually have the last out. We were the home team, and we were winning. So, no, we were losing. So in the top of the ninth, Rich Aurelia caught a line drive at short, and I was playing left. He turned around, threw me the ball, and I put it in my back pocket. So I still have that ball, the last out recorded by a Giant at Candlestick Park. It's in my trophy case, and being a kid that grew up in Northern California, Giants fan, it's pretty cool.
Very cool. If we move to 2000, you go down south, you play for the Dodgers, you play with Gary Sheffield. So we talked about Vlad Guerrero, we talked about Bonds. Like, what can you say about Sheffield and watching him hit?
Well, he was real quiet, so I never really got to know Gary, you know, like as intimately as I did Barry. But watching him on a daily basis, just same kind of thing, just pounce on a strike and always ready to hit. While Barry was smooth, the Chef was violent. Like his swing was violent, you know, with the bat wiggle, yeah. And then you know he'd swing and hit the bat on the ground. And yeah, he was more of a max effort guy, where Barry was more smooth at what he did. But they both, when they hit him, boy, I'll tell you what. You know, Barry, you know, Chef was a good teammate, and Barry gets a lot of crap for not being a good teammate. But I think Barry was a little bit better of a teammate than Gary was. They were both good, but like, I think Barry deserves more credit for being a good teammate that he doesn't get a lot of.
Barry didn't take you in the, do a soft toss for you?
Oh, Chef, no, Chef. Chef was just like in his locker, go to work, shower, leave. All pro, man. Just everything about him was pro and businesslike.
FP, you've been on both sides of this rivalry. I haven't been a part of this, but Dodgers, Giants, compare and contrast the rivalry in your head, being both on both sides of that rivalry.
Well, I think in Northern California, the fans are a little bit more into it. I think anybody that's played in that series, regardless of what uniform they're wearing, I played in the last game at Candlestick as a Giant, and the first game at, I think it was Pac Bell then, as a Dodger. So I was on the other side the next year. And I think you feel the rivalry more when you're in Northern California than you do when you're in Southern California as a player. That's not to say Dodger fans aren't passionate, because as you can see right now with the World Series going on, they're very passionate. But I think when you talk about true rivalry in the spirit, in the sportsmanship sense, and the taking the rivalry seriously, but not like, you know, too seriously, which a lot of fans do, which I don't understand. I think that the more passionate fan and the more passionate atmosphere is in San Francisco versus Los Angeles.
Give me your, the Nats Phillies. Give me the compare and contrast there.
I don't think it's a budding rivalry, because when you're talking Dodgers Giants, you're talking, you know, back to New York and back to Brooklyn. And when you're talking Red Sox, Yankees, you're talking hundreds of years. So when you're talking Nats and Phillies, you're only talking like 15 years. And the first, you know, I don't know, eight of them were all Phillies winning World Series and winning divisions. And now it's kind of flip-flop, where the Nats are the world champs or the defending world champs, and the Phillies are trying to get back to the playoffs. So I think the interesting aspect of that rivalry is Bryce Harper signing with the Phillies and being a Nat for so long, and now he's a Philly, and then he went to Philadelphia and the Nats won the World Series, and then he slipped up in his press conference and said, "I'm going to bring a title back to DC," in his Philly press conference, which obviously when the Nats won it last October went viral. But he was right. Bryce is right. So I don't know. I think they got the right manager there right now. I like Joe Girardi a lot, and I respect that organization a lot. As a player, when I played, Pete McCannon, who was the manager there for a number of years, is one of my best friends in baseball. So Philly fans think I hate the Phillies just because I'm a homer on the broadcast, but I have tons of respect for that city and that franchise.
So if we move out west, 2001, you played for the A's. We had Eric Burns on the show. He talked about the clubhouse, and he described it as Animal House. How would you describe the clubhouse and the group of guys when you were there in 2001?
Well, if you've ever watched any sort of documentary on Motley Crue when they were at their height, that was us, but we were playing baseball. And, you know, the best part about that is we were 102-60 the year I was there. So while we had our fun off the field, and I'm not joking about Motley Crue, by the way, things I saw in Oakland the year I was there, I've never seen in baseball or have never seen since. But we won every night. We didn't just win. We won 10-2 every night. And when I was in AAA for a little bit, I got called up in July. We were right around 500. So we ended up 102-60. So you talk about winning every single night while I was there and part of it. I had nothing to do with it. But to see the chemistry with Jason Giambi and Miguel Tejada and Eric Chavez and Jermaine Dye and Johnny Damon and Terrence Long and Mulder, Zito, and Hudson and Jason Isringhausen. And you guys, I'm sure Bernsey told you, when we went out after games, it wasn't just two or three guys like most teams. It was 15, 18 guys every single night. And, you know, there's so much to be said for analytics in today's game, and I get it. But until you can quantify for me what team chemistry is and how that translates when you had, you know, everybody going out, didn't matter who you are, where you were from, what kind of music you listened to, what your background was. It was such a diverse group, but we were all so close. It was like a family. And we went out every night and we took over whatever restaurant we went to. We took over whatever bar we went to. We stayed out late and we had fun. But Jason Giambi was our ringleader and we kind of followed his lead. And he was always ready to play the next day. He was always ready to compete at the highest level the next day, regardless of what we did on the road the night before. So we used to sit there. I was 36 at the time, so I was on my way out. But I used to sit there and go, well, if Jason Giambi, the former MVP, is ready to play today, I damn well better be ready to play today. And I think everybody else took that lead. So it was like, you know, party hard, sleep hard, play hard kind of a thing. And we all knew that we had a responsibility to each other. And when we went out like that and we all hung out like that, it made us such a close group that we generally loved each other. We respected each other and we wanted to win for each other. And things that I never saw happen before, we also wanted the game to get over quick for each other because we had plans after the game. And guys would be on the bench in the middle of the game going, can we start making some outs, man? I got shit to do tonight. And we're supposed to be at the club at like midnight and this game's going too long, so we need to start making outs. So I had never heard that before. And Billy Beane's amazing. He gave me a chance in Oakland. But the guy that I think gets not enough credit in all this is Art Howe. That the movie made him out to be who he isn't. He's one of the nicest gentlemen I've ever met in my life and one of the smartest baseball men I've ever met in my life. He's so humble and he's so unassuming. And he defers all the credit to the players that I just hope someday that Art Howe gets the justice he deserves and the credit he deserves more accurately as a manager, because he was the guy that looked the other way when he had to or thought it was appropriate, but also was firm enough to pull you aside and said, hey, you need to reel it in a little bit. And during the game and the lineups and the matchups, the communication during batting practice about when you're going to play as a bench player, just one of the best managers I ever played for. And I hope he gets the due he deserves because he's awesome.
Sounds like we need to, everything that you and Burns have said about this A's team, we need to do a remake, not call it Moneyball, but call it Motley Crue Ball.
Yeah.
And like get you guys together and a director to put things together. Then we'll put better light on our how.
Well, you could do that for the guys like me that are divorced. But the guys that are still married, I don't think would sign off on that movie at all. And there's things we could do before smartphones if these guys can't do today. If there were smartphones, we all said we'd be in jail. So it's good that they're, you know, we got the last little generation of baseball to do our thing off the field.
All right. So, FP, as we wrap up here, we've got this thing we call West Coast Swing. It's kind of rapid fire. There's no right or wrong answers. And it's called FP's First Time. But believe me, it's PG-13. My mom listens to the pod and so does that. All right. So your first major league hit was August 2nd, 1995. Your first game was August 2nd, 1995. Can you describe what was going through your head when you got called up and you got put in the lineup?
Well, I spent 7 years in the minors, man, and I never said anything to anybody. And about a week before, I pulled our minor league director, Bill Guyvette, to the side, and I said, hey, I'm hitting 270, 280 in AAA every year. I'm playing seven different positions. I'm making no errors. My manager, Pete McCannon, says I could be one of the best bench players in the big leagues if I'm given a chance. I think I've paid my dues down here. I need a chance. I deserve a chance. So I finally spoke up for myself. I got called up like a week later. I got there at noon for a 7 o'clock game. The locker room was closed and Bill Stoneman was the GM. He let me in. He said, don't you think you're a little early? First of all, congratulations. Don't you think you're a little early? And I said, I've been waiting my whole life for this, man. There's no such thing as early. Felipe Alou saw me in the locker room at like one when he got there, put me in the lineup because I got there so early, which was a curse to my kids because they were always the first ones at games because of that day. in soccer and baseball growing up, they hated it. But he put me in the lineup and I got two hits. I got a hit my second time up. A triple was my first major league hit. And then I got a hit my last time up, went 2 for 3 and spent 7 years in the big league. So, yeah, I remember trying not to cry during the national anthem because it took so long to get there. And, like, I can't let these guys see me cry in the national anthem, man. I got to, like, hold it together. I got to lock it in here. And then I grounded out my first time up. And Darren Fletcher is on the bench. I'm like, did I look okay? And he's like, yeah, you hit that ball hard. And I'm like, could you see my back leg shaking? It was shaking pretty hard. He's like, no. He goes, you're good. And I got to hit my next time up. So
take us through that hit. It was off Sergio Valdez.
It was off Chris Hammond. Left.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, tripled off Chris Hammond, the fifth.
Chris Hammond, yeah, I'll never forget that. It was a runner on second, nobody out. I was hitting eighth in the National League. So I asked Jerry Manuel, our third base coach. I'm like, am I trying to get him over with the pitcher on deck, runner on second, nobody out? He's like, just drive him into the right side. If you miss, I think Jeff Becerra was pitching. He's like, he can hit. He'll drive him in. So I was hitting right-handed because of lefty, and I hit a triple down the right field line trying to move the runner. And I was dead pulled left, right-handed. So actually like inside out or something. Hit it, barreled it up down the right field line, and I don't even remember running around the bases. I think I blacked out. It's pretty cool. And then I just saw it like, I don't know, like a year ago. They had me on Intentional Talk on the MLB Network. Mm-hmm. And they say, do you remember your first hit? And they showed it. And that's the first time I ever saw it. Like the TV broadcast of my first hit. It's pretty cool.
Very cool. Yeah. Can you talk about your first home run?
That might have been off Sergio Valdez, right?
That was, yes.
Yeah. That was against the Giants. So that was pretty cool because a Northern California kid playing in Montreal, I knew everybody at home was watching. So you always want to put a good show on for everyone at home that's getting the game locally. That's before, you know, you could just tune into any game and the MLB package and all that. So I knew everybody in the Bay Area, Northern California was watching. And I don't know. I wasn't a home run hitter. I just ran into one. I only hit 20 or 21 my whole career. But I do remember that one. It was a pretty cool feeling jogging around the bases at the major league level.
Is that a night game in Candlestick?
No, it was in Montreal, I have the ball. I have two baseballs in my mantle, not here in D.C., but at home at my parents' house, and it's my first hit, my first home run. Those are the only two baseballs I have.
All right, so if we move to the World Series, the Dodgers will win the World Series if?
If they win four games before the race. I'm not the best analyst in the league for nothing. They will win the World Series if they win game six. But if it goes to game seven, who knows? I know that the last year the Astros were up 3-2 against the Nats, and we were going back to Houston. And the Nats knew, and, you know, I'd broadcast every game all year, and I felt like as a former player, if they won game six, you win game six, you have the momentum for game seven. Like you do. You're going to – I feel like if you win game six, you're going to win game seven. So in my opinion, the Dodgers have to win tomorrow and be done with this, because if it goes to game seven, who knows how you're sleeping, who knows who's pitching, who knows – I mean, the pressure is so great. It's game seven. It's in your head. And anything can happen. It's cliche, but we saw it last year. Anything can happen in game seven. So long answer to your question is, you know, if the Dodgers win the game six, they win the World Series. You know, not being a smartass. Like if they win game six, they win it. If they don't, I don't know if they win it.
All right, FP, we've had you for 33 minutes. Can you hang with us for four more minutes?
Sure.
I want to get into, I feel like these are the best stories generally, the recruitment. How'd you get out to Miami? So you were a star back in after winning a Cal State title, Conference Player of the Year at Sac City College. Take us through, how'd you end up in Coral Gables?
That's a good question. I went to Cal Berkeley out of a high school, and I had a baseball scholarship. And so as a freshman, I kind of paid my dues, and I was supposed to be the shortstop the next year. And Jeff Kent came in as a recruit, and he started at shortstop. So I went in and said to the coach there, Bob Milano, I don't see myself playing here a whole lot with this guy, and I'm going to transfer back to Sac City Junior College. Jerry Weinstein, the coach there, was always good to me while I was in high school, and now he's one of my best friends on the planet. We talk once a week, and he's one of the best baseball people I know and one of the best people, period, I know. And he took me in, and I started playing there, and I got recruited by everybody all over again, man. You name it, I got recruited. And something about when I went to Miami on my recruiting trip, and I knew I wanted to play in Omaha. I wanted to win a national championship. So we won the championship at Sac City, and I wanted to win another one, and I thought they had the best chance. And they gave me a full ride. I didn't have to pay for a dime. They flew out all the way from Miami, sat at dinner with my parents, the assistant coach. Ron Frazier was the head coach back then, college legend. He was friends with Tommy Lasorda. Tommy Lasorda called me one night at home, and I talked to Tommy for like an hour on the phone. You know, as a 21-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid, whatever I was back then. So, yeah, then I went across the country, and we were ranked number one. We went to Omaha, but we didn't win at all. It was a fun year there. And my roommate and best friend is actually the head coach there now, Gino Damari. And I was the keynote speaker at their banquet last year. And we joked that I got their season canceled, that was my fault. because of COVID last year. But yeah, so I still have ties to the program because of Gino, and he has me down there all the time. And I always kind of talk to the team at practice whenever spring training is in West Palm Beach for the Nats. So I'll go down to Coral Gables a lot, and I'm still real close to the program.
Now, our intern should have done better research for us on this next question. Greg Vaughn is from Sac and played at Miami. Did you guys overlap at all, either playing in Sac or Miami?
No, but I think I screwed up my answer. So Jerry Weinstein was a coach at Sac City, but he left Sac City for like 3 years to coach at Miami. So all of a sudden there was a pipeline there from Miami to Sac City. So they would come out and recruit. I think John Leak was the first guy that I can remember that went from Sac City to Miami. Then Greg Vaughn went before me from Sac City to Miami. And then I think I might have been one of the next guys to go from Sac City to Miami. So there was a connection there and a pipeline. And I think up until recently, they still recruited out of Sac City. I don't know if any guys have gone there recently, but it's been one that's lasted over the years.
Who is the best opposing baseball player you face in the collegiate ranks during that year? There had to be a ton.
Dude, you're talking about 1989, man. It's 2020. I mean, it's not like I played at Miami last year.
You look like you could have come out of college yesterday, FP.
No, well, thanks. But I can't. I remember playing the Cape League between Sac City and Miami, and that was stacked with they say it was one of the best years there with Mo Vaughn and Frank Thomas and Jeff Bagwell. And I think Biggio might have been there. Jeff Kent was there. I mean, it was a great year in the Cape. And I remember thinking, if this is what Division I baseball is like, wow. So that was a great experience playing down there. But as far as at Miami, I honestly couldn't tell you. I can't remember. I just remember the Cape Cod League, and a lot of big names were there.
Well, as we wrap up, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online and check you out and follow you?
No, I can't. I'm very private, and I don't think I want anybody to follow me. I'll give them my address, though. You guys,
your Twitter handle's in the little ticker there.
If you want to say, come knock on the door. Especially, no, I can't say that. I almost said something back. No, I'm at Fightin' Hydrant on Twitter. Mike Kruko gave me that nickname. He said I look like a fire hydrant that wanted to fight you. So he called me the Fightin' Hydrant my year in San Francisco. So that's my Twitter handle. And I'm at FP Santangelo 7 on Instagram. So,
yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining the show. We appreciate it. Sorry we missed the birthday party, but with COVID, maybe next year we'll fly out and join you for a game, man. In DC.
When it gets normal again, we had like 6 people here. It was lame, but yeah, we're all socially distant outside. Whatever. We're doing the best we can. Thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
No problem. I appreciate it. Thanks, FP.
All right.